Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, taxi, RV, camper, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and Coast is coming to you live tonight, this morning, from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640, and the studios of Chorus Entertainment here on the north shore of Lake Ontario, where our Raptors are out of the NBA playoffs, but exceeded everyone's expectations by forcing the powerful Cleveland Cavaliers to six games in the semifinals. But on a positive note, our Blue Jays have won two out of three against the Eastern Division leading Boston Red Sox. So all is not lost here in Toronto in terms of sporting events. Baseball fans have a lot in common with people who grow vegetable gardens. In the spring, hope springs eternal. I planted a couple of rows of carrots today and about two dozen tomato plants, a few varieties of peppers, some beans, peas, Swiss chard, beets, zucchini, cucumbers, assorted herbs, and some pumpkins for my little guys. I'm not a prepper. I just like vegetables. So wherever you are, I wish you good weather and a bountiful garden. And we have a great show for you tonight. And just like my vegetable garden, tonight's show promises variety. A little paranormal mixed in with a real political thriller. In the final 3 hours of the program, President Ronald Reagan's secret agent, Ambassador Lee Wanta, returns to the program. Lee Wanta is also known as the $27 trillion man, although that's gone up since the last time we had him on the show due to inflation. Lee Wanta and his official biographer, Lon Gibby, will be here to discuss how Wanta was recruited by America's 40th president to bring the former Soviet Union to its knees using some sophisticated financial maneuvers, including elaborate currency swaps. And according to Wanta, this caused the complete and utter collapse of the Russian ruble and was responsible for the end of the Cold War. But Wanta's currency swaps and other financial transactions ended up netting the U.S. Treasury tens of trillions of dollars. And it was Ronald Reagan's intention that this enormous sum of money was to be repatriated to the United States and used to wipe out America's huge debt. It was also intended to be used to finance major infrastructure projects across America. So what happened? What happened to Ambassador Lee Wanta and those trillions of dollars? His biography, Lon Gibby, will be here in hour two to fill in some of the details on this remarkable story that sounds like it was ripped from the pages of an Ian Fleming novel. But Lee Wanta isn't James Bond. He's real. He lived it. And he'll join us in hour three for a Coast to Coast AM exclusive from Parts Unknown to tell us where those trillions of dollars are, how he aims to get that money repatriated, and who exactly is standing in the way. That covers off the political subterfuge portion of the program. Now, I promised some paranormal. And in the first hour, coming up after the break, you're going to hear a remarkable story that is sure to check all the boxes. It's a baffling mystery involving two separate car pileups, one on the M6 motorway in the United Kingdom, and then a few months later, a multi-car pileup in Paris. In the M6 crash, eyewitnesses, including a police officer on the scene, allegedly reported that the occupants of the lead two cars in the crash were missing. They never turned up. They simply vanished, never found. In the case of the Paris crash, eyewitnesses allegedly reported that the victims of the crash momentarily disappeared and then reappeared. The bodies from the Paris crash were then transported to a morgue located in a Paris hospital, and while there, were subjected to a very strange post-mortem medical procedure, allegedly caught on a hospital surveillance camera. Colin Hall is the author of Fact or Fiction, Volume 1, The Paris and M6 Crashes. And he joins me next to unravel perhaps the most bizarre, disturbing, potentially supernatural occurrence of the young 21st century. In the meantime, Get on up to the coasttocoastam.com website, and if you haven't already done so, please register now and become a member of the Coast Insiders Club. Now, just a reminder, there's only a couple days left in May, and during the month of May, you get to experience full membership benefits for just, get this, 99 cents for the first month. And that'll entitle you to 5 years of MP3 downloads and streams. That's over 1,800 shows to listen to and collect. Full audio access to recent shows via the mobile app. You can chat with hosts and special guests, iTunes podcast, direct email to the show host. It's a great deal, and it's very easy to sign up and register. Again, just go to coasttocoastam.com. All right, we've got a real strange one coming your way. Colin Hall standing by live from the UK to fill us in on the M6 and Paris crashes. So come on in, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Welcome back to Coast AM. Colin Hall is a security consultant based in England and the author of Fact or Fiction Volume 1, The Paris and M6 Crashes. Colin has been investigating the M6 and Paris paranormal crashes, two separate multi-vehicle pileups, it's claimed, where people disappeared before eyewitnesses and a mysterious white light was caught on surveillance video streaking across the motorways just before the accident. Colin Hall, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Very good, Richard, and thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. All right, give us the thumbnail sketch of this most bizarre incident. I'm guessing, as they say, we're going to catch a lot of flies tonight. People are going to be sitting there with their mouths wide open listening to this story. But take us back to the beginning. What happened?
Well, what we now know, in November 2009, allegedly, there was a multi-vehicle pileup on the M6 motorway just outside Birmingham, Junction 11. In which the front three vehicles, each or the occupants in each of those vehicles allegedly disappeared. What we also know now is that there was a police officer in attendance which confirmed this on an audio clip, again, allegedly. Fast forward 3 months, 4 months after that, in March, back in March 2010, again, something similar, a bright light preempted another crash, this time involving at least two vehicles. This time, there are allegations that the passengers or the occupants in those vehicles disappeared and then reappeared again. They were carted off to the morgue at the Petit Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, not the nearest hospital, I hasten to add, to the crash scene. And then we have this strange spectre of the morgue being broken into, someone being caught on camera in the hospital, that we now know, and injecting them with some form of a device, which we now have on camera. They only got to three out of the four bodies. The three that they got and the one that they didn't flagged up different results in their blood tests. So certainly there was something going on with the device that he used on those bodies. So, yeah, it was a bit of a strange one, to say the least.
Well, let's compare and contrast the two events. So again, just to recap, November 2009, Junction 11 on the M6 motorway in the UK near Birmingham, England. Yep. We have a multi-car pileup, and we're going to use the word alleged a lot during this hour because there is so much speculation. Some are calling this entire event a hoax, an urban legend, and we'll sort of try to unravel this mystery. But again, to compare the M6 incident, you have a multi-car pileup, you have eyewitnesses, there's that word, allegedly, reporting that the car crash was precipitated by a flash of bright white light. The tarmac, or the pavement, is on fire. The lead couple of cars in the crash are on fire. And when a police officer on the scene looks into the two the lead vehicles, there is nobody in there. Nobody is present in the vehicles, and it's not a situation where the bodies were, you know, burned beyond recognition. I mean, that doesn't happen I mean, that does happen, but the bodies would not simply disappear. They wouldn't be incinerated. Do I have it right so far?
You do, and exactly that. I mean, you know, as we can hear on this audio, you know, the officer clearly states there's nobody in those front three vehicles, in fact, and there is no trace of where they went, and there was this bright light that preempted this particular accident.
And you mentioned the audio, because a little bit later in the hour, perhaps after the bottom of the hour, we're going to play a transmission from a police audio transmission, alleged police audio transmission, because I guess it's still to be determined whether this is authentic, correct?
That's correct, yes, very much so as well.
All right. Now, again, let's go to the Paris crash, which happened in March of 2010. So the M6 crash, November 2009, and then a crash, a multi-car pileup in Paris, eerily similar to the M6 crash in March of 2010. Again, this is not on a highway. This is just a busy Paris street near the Eiffel Tower, correct?
That's correct. Just off the Avenue de New York, ironically, yeah.
And again, a bright light, cars on fire, tarmac on fire, lead vehicles involved in the pileup on fire.
Yes. What's slightly different though with this one is that there is an allegation that the occupants of those vehicles disappeared, then reappeared. So there were still bodies at the scene of this particular crash, which is perhaps the most significant difference between the two. Incidents.
Right. So there were reported fatalities. Now, when you say disappeared and then reappeared, you mean literally, according to alleged eyewitness accounts, literally these bodies flitted in and out of reality or existence. They were there, then they weren't there in the cars.
Yes. And, you know, there's been a steady stream of, I say, evidence, allegations that have been flowing out from one particular source. And, you know, the witnesses are now stating that initially these occupants, well, they were black, and then they came back white. Now, I hasten to add, this is completely and utterly uncorroborated, but that is a statement that was apparently read from a witness statement that resided with the police authorities in Paris.
Colin Hall is with us here on Coast to Coast AM, security consultant. He's based in England, and he is the author of Fact or Fiction, Volume 1, The Paris and M6 Crashes. Now, the source of this story is almost as mysterious as the story itself, and that is an online journalist in the UK by the name of Mark Collins. Is that how you got this story, from his blogs or his online reports?
Yes, I mean, in my day job as a security consultant, I was doing some routine investigations into a route which incorporated the M6. Quite by accident, I came across these reports, and these reports were everywhere, including the USA Today, including the Huffington Post, and then pretty much every single sort of paranormal website that you can ever imagine. The source of these reports was Mark Collins.
And what do we know about Mark Collins? Is he a reputable journalist? Has he worked for reputable publications? The Daily Mail, the London Mirror.
No, all we know of is that he was a, for want of a better word, a hack. He was trying to get his journalistic career off the ground. I've never had any face-to-face contact with him. I've had some contact online, but nothing that was particularly significant. But other than that, no, there's no record of him writing for anything other than a couple of small-time websites, and that was about it.
So what really convinced you that this was a story worth pursuing, rather than it simply being an online hoax perpetrated by a hack, as you describe him?
I think it was the sheer scale of it. You know, we come across hoaxes every day. With this one, it was slightly different. There weren't little green men running out of flying saucers across a field, waving hello. This seemed to have some sort of basis in reality. And I think also when you look online at the sheer scale of it, you know, after a very short space of time, clearly there was a lot of interest in it. And I think, you know, in my line of work, we're taught to sort of be curious. It caught me. It grabbed me and it drew me in. And, you know, there I was scribbling notes and talking about it when, you know, clearly it could have been one of three things. It could have been a hoax. Could have been a cover-up. It could have, in fact, been real. So, you know, it just completely and utterly captivated me, and that's why I scribbled down the notes, and that's why I put the book out.
And we do have a piece of audio a tape that we'll play after the bottom of the hour, which is allegedly a police radio transmission. This would be from, I guess, traffic control headquarters, and a police officer, a British police officer, who was on the scene at Junction 11. Yeah. And as you say, this piece of audio tape, what steps are you taking to authenticate that this is actually a real police transmission?
Well, there are two or three things. I mean, firstly, I've got a very close friend who's a forensic analyst, should I say, of audio. He's currently with that audio now, listening to it on many different levels. They'll sit down with it over a period of weeks and pull it apart. We've also got a Freedom of Information Act request in to try and ascertain that there was indeed an incident at that time. You know, what we didn't have before was a date or a location. We were always guessing. We now have these. And then, you know, finally, viewers, you know, or listeners. I mean, I had someone contact me via the last time we spoke, who was clear that the language used in that audio clip meant that it couldn't be real. And it was very interesting because, you know, we had an exchange of emails about this. And I think the way we left it is the Freedom of Information Act is key, but also, you know, as much as we could be convinced that the language or the police coding that was used could be wrong, there isn't a lot to explain why it's wrong and also what the motive is. So, yeah, I mean, there are two or three things that are going on at the moment.
And the fact that this piece of audio tape, this police radio transmission, wasn't released before and somehow it was uncovered and released now would tend to point, you believe, to a cover-up at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, there are always scales of or levels to which people would go to create a hoax, and I think when we start looking at creating audio clips and, you know, also the latter released video clip that we've seen, I think you've got to start to wonder why. What is the motive behind all this? And I think the motive has been the biggest struggle for me, is that if this is a hoax, for what reason would you do it? And you know, there are very, very few people out there that would have the capability and the financing to pull this off just for the sheer hell of it. So your natural inclination is to look and think, well, hang on a minute, is this, again, part of a cover-up to cover up something else slightly more sinister? And that's almost the default setting that I've gone to on this is, you know, why would you do it and who is behind it? And there's a lot of expertise involved in this. A lot of expertise. So, you know, there's got to be a serious reason for this to now find its way into the public domain.
And what to you is, in terms of the M6 crash, is, and we'll talk about the Paris crash in a moment, but what to you is the most perplexing aspect of the M6 crash that happened near Birmingham at Junction 11 in November 2009? Is it the fact that the occupants of the lead three vehicles in the crash completely vanished, and there are a number of possible explanations for that, or is it the blinding white light that people reported in advance of the crash?
Well, I mean, blinding white light could theoretically be lightning. So, you know, there are reasons for that could quite easily explain that occurrence. I think what is more perplexing is where these people went. To have occupants completely disappear out of a vehicle with no trace, and as you said, earlier on, there is no trace, nothing, no burn marks, no bones or anything. That, to me, is the most perplexing part of what happened on the M6.
All right. Colin Hall, stay where you are. We will come back in a few moments and try at least to unravel this this mystery, this riddle wrapped in an enigma, dipped in a chocolatey coating, the M6 and Paris crashes with Colin Hall. I Feel Free by Cream, taking us into the break. My name is Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. President Ronald Reagan's secret agent Lee Wanta, the $31.2 trillion man, is coming up later on Coast to Coast. And when we come back, we're going to hear more from Colin Hall, a security specialist and author of Fact or Fiction, The Paris M6 Crashes, Volume 1. Now, before that, let me just play this. This is an audio recording, an alleged police transmission between traffic control and a police officer who arrives on the scene at this multi-car pileup at the Junction 11 M6 near Birmingham, England. And, well, check it out. Is allegedly a police radio transmission from traffic control to a police officer on the scene at a multi-car pileup on the M6 motorway. That's near Birmingham, England, and this was in November 2009. And as you heard from the audio, the police officer on the scene, corroborating what author Colin Hall has been telling us, the lead three vehicles in the pileup are on fire and completely empty, and the occupants were never found, never showed up. Now, is this a hoax, an urban legend, a complete fabrication, or is there a cover-up involved? Is there something paranormal going on? We'll find out when my conversation with Colin Hall continues right after this on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. Colin Hall is with us, security consultant based in England, the author of Fact or Fiction, Volume 1, The Paris and M6 Crashes. We just heard during the last segment the alleged audio recording, a police radio transmission between traffic control and a police officer on the scene on the M6 near Birmingham, England, reporting that the lead three cars in the pileup were on fire and completely empty. Now, where did this audio tape come from? How did you get a hold of it, Colin?
Well, there's been a leak online. As you know, there's been this whistleblower going by the name of Sanford Is Right via Twitter. And this leak is clearly bent on getting this stuff out there. So what we've had over the last month or two has been a continuous sort of trawl of bits and pieces that have come out. We've had this audio clip, we've had a video clip, we've had a couple of images. He claims to have more on a hard drive. He claims to have been part of the investigation. He claims that, you know, this was buried. You know, the cases, both incidents were buried, and the reason why he's surfaced after so long is that, you know, clearly he's been able to decrypt these files. So, you know, as with anyone who's been involved or watched this, you know, with interest over the last few years, I was clearly sparked back into action, because until that point, largely, nothing had happened.
All right, let's talk now about the Paris crash. Again, this happens roughly 4 months later, March 2010.
Yes.
And multi-car pileup, lead vehicles on fire. Witnesses allegedly report the victims, and there were four fatalities in these lead cars, sort of flitting in and out of reality. In other words, they disappeared and then they reappeared. Now, the bodies are taken to a hospital morgue in Paris. This is the same hospital, well, I don't know if I would say coincidentally, but it's interesting to note, it's the same hospital where Princess Diana was taken, correct?
That is correct. And here's the interesting thing with this. As we sort of delve deeper into the reports by Mark Collins, there is a report about body tampering. Clearly, that particular hospital and the words body tampering are extraordinarily sensitive.
Indeed, yes. Indeed.
Again, motive. You look at motive and you think, well, is that a potential motive? Was this covered up for some reason other than the actual incident itself? I don't know. One thing we do have, this device caught on camera, and we have this suspect, the alleged suspect, I should say, caught in a lift on CCTV. So we actually have a visual on who may have been caught in the morgue. But then, interestingly enough, if you wind the clock back 2 years ago and you look at Mark Collins's Twitter feed, there was an image, an artist's impression of what he believed was the suspect. And there is a striking similarity between the two.
And where can people see the artist's rendering of this initial suspect 2 years ago that was seen in the elevator at this hospital and then again later in the morgue performing this strange post-mortem procedure on the victims?
Where can we see this? I posted quite a lot on my feed at the moment, which is Colin Z. Hall, at Colin Z. Hall. If you go and search for Mark Collins, I think his is M. Collins blog or something like that, you'll see what he posted, and you'll see that it was posted nearly 2 years ago that the first image was posted.
And this is kind of a police sketch, a police artist sketch of the...
And you know what? This is the interesting thing again. Why would you engineer evidence to fit something that was posted 2 years ago? It doesn't make sense. And I think at every single turn with this, particularly in Paris, actually, it doesn't make sense. Why would there be witness statements saying that people change their physical appearance? You know, there are also apparently, again, coming out of this other feed, statements that there were two positive IDs, that the main suspect was initially in one of these vehicles. That doesn't make sense either. Now, that could be clearly, someone just getting confused.
Let me just back up there a moment, because you said a number of interesting things here, and I want to pick up on these threads.
Yeah.
So again, now we're talking about the Paris crash in March of 2010. We're talking about this suspect, let's call him a suspect, that was seen in the elevator at the Paris hospital where the victims of the crash were taken. He's seen in the elevator and then moments later caught on a security camera in the morgue, performing some sort of procedure, post-mortem procedure, on these bodies.
We've got CCTV of him in the lift, not in the morgue. We have witness statements to suggest he was arrested in the morgue. And the three of the bodies show puncture wounds. One of them didn't. The one that didn't threw up an anomaly on the blood test results. The three that were punctured by this device all had pretty much identical blood test results.
So we have a suspect. He's arrested. We have bodies. Do we have any names? I mean, if we have fatalities, I mean, there must be a record at the hospital with the police. Next of kin must have been notified to identify who these people are.
You would think so. And again, this is something that I'm trying to work on now. Now I've got, you know, a little bit more evidence to work with, it's a little bit easier to go out to people and say, right, do you recognize this person? You know, before, it was all guesswork and it was very difficult. But now we know when this crash took place. We definitely know where it took place. And we've now got an image of the suspect. So, yeah, I mean, I am out trying to find out who this person is. At the moment, no luck, but it is very early days.
Have you filed a Freedom of Information request? If I don't know if they have such a thing in France, but what steps have you taken to uncover who these victims were, who this individual who was arrested, who these people are?
I'm doing exactly that. I mean, again, bear in mind this video clip. I mean, it came out 2 weeks ago, was it 3 weeks ago? So again, very early stages, but exactly that. I'm trying to file some form of Freedom of Information Act request, or the French equivalent, to ascertain, A, that there was an incident, B, the location, and then C, this person. Is there a positive ID on this person? Do we know who he is?
And for those who haven't seen the closed circuit security camera in the morgue at this Paris hospital, explain, or at least what the witnesses supposedly saw, this individual doing to the victims of the Paris crash. Walk us through that.
Well, we're being told that this person broke in to the morgue. That's the first. We don't know how he did it. What we do know now from the clip in the lift is that this person definitely had the device because he took it out of his inside jacket pocket. So we can clearly confirmed the device and him were both present in that hospital. We're then being told that this person broke into the morgue and he injected 3 out of the 4 bodies. Before he could inject the fourth one, however, he was apprehended by the authorities and stopped. We then have, we've got a shaky image of the device on the floor of the morgue that apparently was taken by one of the morgue technicians. And we have testimony that 3 of the 4 bodies had blood results that would be considered normal. One wasn't. But here's the other thing about those tests that they were carrying out. Apparently, all the bodies contained reasonably high levels of succinylcholine. Enough to suggest...
Sorry, they contained... I wasn't able to...
Drive.
Sorry, Colin, explain. What was that was present in their blood again?
Succinylcholine. Sucks. It's basically... It's like... I think dentists use it. You know, it's like, you know, when they're trying, you know, put people out before an operation.
Right. Like almost like an anesthesia.
Yes, basically, yes. But again, from this source that keeps throwing stuff out there into the public domain, what he is suggesting is there was enough of it in those bodies to suggest they could not control a vehicle. Which is very interesting because they were, you know, completely in control with them until they crashed, of course.
Where are the witnesses? I mean, I understand how you can keep police officials quiet, how you could keep first responders quiet, but how do you keep people on the street? So many people who must have witnessed a multi-car pileup. It's not every day you see a fiery crash on a street. Or on the M6 motorway, people that were maybe had been involved further back in the car pileup. Where are these people? Have you put out a plaintiff call online or through the media for these people to come forward? And where are they?
Well, yes. Firstly, I don't know where they are. I don't know who they are, and I don't know how they've been kept quiet. I have, on many occasions, asked for these witnesses to come forward. Nobody has. And that, again, is another mystery because, as you quite rightly say, it's easy to keep, you know, officialdom quiet. It's easy to make sure that people don't say anything in the public domain. Witnesses less so. You know, it's almost impossible to keep a witness quiet. I mean, you can keep them quiet for a while, but not, you know, forever. And given the nature of these incidents, you would have thought that they would have been, they would have spoken to somebody. But nothing, absolute silence, which again, it always sort of, it points me back to that whole issue of motive, which then points me to the whole issue of was this a cover-up of something that happened was it's a complete diversion away from what really happened at those two crash sites. Because if you're going to create something that is so spectacularly over the top that you take people's eye off from what really happened. But I don't know what, if you like, what sparked this evidence to come out. Something clearly somewhere, if this is a cover-up, has happened for somebody to go out there and put this evidence into the public domain. Clearly, if it was manufactured, you know, there has to be a reason why. So perhaps one of these witnesses was close to speaking out publicly, and this is, if you like, heading them off at the pass.
And meanwhile, there are families out there who are missing loved ones, those that were involved in the M6 car pileup, those occupants of those cars disappeared. We have the fatalities in the Paris crash. Those people are gone. They have families, obviously, one would assume, that are missing them. You would think that they would come forward as well.
Yes, absolutely. And again, this is where the whole thing sort of descends into mystery, because there are certain aspects to these incidents that just simply don't make sense. And you're right, families, you know, where are these people's relatives? You know, what are they saying? Have they said anything? Have they been contacted? Well, you'd like to presume they had. But again, have they been silenced? Have they been told to keep quiet?
We just have a couple of minutes here. Colin, would you care to speculate on what is behind all this? Let's assume it's not a hoax, and the occupants of the cars involved in the pileup on the M6, the cars involved in the similar, eerily similar pileup on the street in Paris did in fact completely vanish, although in Paris they reappeared. What do you think is going on here?
Well, there are a couple of things that could be going on, and I think the more I've got into this, the more I'd say, you know, cover up is perhaps the logical route. You know, I would speculate it could be some form of a military experiment that went wrong. You know, because when you look at it, the military, the only people that probably have the muscle power to cover this up, keep everyone quiet, and then they've got the wherewithal and the technical knowledge to go out and create evidence that would then throw people off the scent. I've even thought that the usage of the terminology RTC versus RTA on the audio clip, or is it the other way around, could have actually been done on purpose to ensure that people realized that the audio clip was fake. So it's sort of, if you like, it's a double bluff, because I always thought the audio clip debunked the video, but clearly it might not be the case. So you've got to look at who could do this, and there are very, very few agencies that could do it, but one of them is certainly the military, and it could have been some form of experiment that just went wrong.
When you say an experiment, what are we talking here? Teleportation?
I don't know. I mean, that it clearly could be one of them. That could, with the light, you would like to suggest that could be an option, yes. But we do know that both accidents had people either disappearing and not reappearing, and then reappearing, having disappeared, allegedly. Now, one
Colin, sorry, Colin, got to cut you there. We'll have to leave it there for now. More to come on this story, I'm sure, and we'll eagerly anticipate new evidence. Colin Hall and the M6 and Paris crashes, Fact or Fiction, Volume 1. Otis Redding, Satisfaction, taking us into the break. On the other side, the $1 trillion man, the $31.2 trillion man, Ronald Reagan's secret agent, Lee Wanta, and his biographer, Lon Gibby, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM.